Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Mary Doria Russell, whose latest novel is A Thread of Grace. Earlier novels are The Sparrow and Children of God, both of which are science fiction novels, but as Mary calls them, they're historical novels set in the future.
Yeah, that's the way I thought of it when I was writing them.
They got a lot of play in the science fiction community.
Yes, but considerably beyond that. I wrote it for people who were actively hostile to the genre, so I was already used to having to set the hook and reel people in and overcome that kind of reluctance to read science fiction.
After writing Children of God, had you already known you were going to write this book?
I knew that I was going to do something about the Jewish underground near Genoa during the Nazi occupation. I knew that I was going to do that. I didn't know that it would end up being this book, but yes, I was doing the research. I was beginning to deepen my understanding of that portion of World War II, starting to read memoirs and getting my head around the topic.
You've said that what attracted you to this topic was a book called Benevolence and Betrayal, Five Italian Jewish Families Under Fascism. At what point did you discover that book, and how did you discover that book?
Well, I'm an Italian by heritage, and I'm a Jew by choice. And I came across that book. It's Alexander Stille, and it's Five Italian Jewish Families Under Fascism. And at that point in my life, I was so ignorant of Italian Jews that I thought I was the only one.
Well, at what point was this? Was this during the writing of The Sparrow? Or?
No, during Children of God. So it must have been around the mid-1990s. I bought that book, and I went home with it. And as I read, everything in it was a surprise to me. Everything was new and fascinating. And most fascinating of all was a section called The Priest, the Rabbi, and the Aviator. And I just thought, this is so dramatic, and this is such a surprise to me. I've got to do something with this story. And so I had it kind of filed in the back of my mind as when I'm done with Children of God and when I'm ready to begin writing again, this is something I want to follow
up. Well, your three main characters, three of your four main characters,
are a priest, a rabbi, and an aviator.
Yeah. Is there any relationship?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. I have, in some ways, used the actual stories of the people that Alexander Stille described and many of whom he interviewed, and I was able to interview some of them as well. But because I was writing a novel, I was able to take elements of various people's personalities and combine them. For example, The Aviator. In my book, all of the most unbelievable things that Renzo Leone does are absolutely out of Alexander Stille's stories about Massimo Tellio, who was the real God.
That means the story of him masquerading as the German Ugo Messner.
Yes. I mean, this guy just did amazing. He had no fear. He rose to the occasion during World War II, during the occupation, and his family said it was as though he had been preparing for this his whole life. And afterwards, that was the high point of his life as well. Now, I then added to his character, because Massimo Tellio was, by all accounts, a completely charming, wonderful, lighthearted guy. I added to the character the elements of the Royal Italian Air Force pilot portion of Renzo Leone's background. And because I wanted to be able to bring through that character parts of Italian history which are almost completely forgotten now and probably never known in America, and that would be the Abyssinian War of 1935. It was like Vietnam for us. It polarized Italian politics. Guys came back from that feeling very different than they had when they left. And so Renzo, there's a portion of his personality that would be like if Lieutenant Calley had come back from My Lai and they gave him a Silver Medal of Honor for it instead of court-martialing him.
Was the promotion for the war in Abyssinia, is there any relationship between Mussolini and Abyssinia and Bush and Iraq?
You know, you could say that. Yes, certainly Mussolini and the people who originally signed on to what became his African adventure. The idea was that they were going to bring the benefits of Italian civilization to Africa. And in fact, they had a very good track record in Sudan and in Libya. They had brought medical care and roads and organization, and those were the best-run colonies in Africa. So despite the fact that it was, in fact, colonialism, they were pretty good at it. They were going to make Abyssinia, which became Ethiopia later, into another Italian colony, and they felt that they would do very well with it. And that's the rationale that Renzo goes there with.
And, of course, he suddenly realizes...
Yes. It's so hard, especially if you begin idealistically, to maintain your source of ethics and morality once the war begins. He is a fighter bomber pilot. He has the experience of having two friends of his captured by the Abyssinian warlords, castrated alive, and then crucified. And he wants revenge, and he takes it.
Mary Doria Russell, the entire story of the war in Italy, World War II in Italy, is a fairly unknown one
Yes.
to us in America. People who know a little bit about it know about the destruction of places like Monte Cassino. To me, my only knowledge of the Jews of Italy comes from a movie.
Garden of the Fenzi Contini.
And that's it. And
Yes.
we know nothing about what happened in northern Italy. Piedmont is a mystery to us.
Yes, and Liguria. Or for that matter, the whole of northern Italy. That was one of the things that I learned by reading Alexander Stille's book. In Benevolence and Betrayal, he says that there were approximately 50,000 Jews in Italy at the beginning of the Nazi occupation. And at the end of the occupation, 43,000 were still alive. It's hard to get the exact figures because, of course, people were in hiding and there were a lot of foreign refugees that had come into Italy. But they believe between 85 and 87% of the Jews of Italy survived a 20-month occupation, and it was a brutal one.
That was after Mussolini fell.
Yeah, he was replaced by the king with Marshal Badoglio. There was a 45-day springtime. And then when Italy surrendered and made a separate peace, the Germans were waiting for it. They suspected that that was going to happen, that that Italy would surrender and change sides. Hitler had been pouring troops into the Italian peninsula for 6 months. The code words were, boil the macaroni. When the armistice was announced, German troops had orders to shoot all Italian officers and disarm the rest of the army. Overnight, Italy went from being Germany's ally to being an occupied country. Despite all of that, despite being a fascist country, despite being an ally of Germany, they had never been anti-Semitic. And as the occupation went on, they saved 85 to 87% of their neighbors and friends and in-laws and just plain strangers who knocked on the door in the middle of the night.
Mary Doria Russell, what about the communists? Did the fascists betray the communists?
The political context for the occupation became the fascists as anti-communists, and the resistance was primarily run by the communists. But as the months went on, more and more small resistance groups coalesced, and everybody put aside whatever political and religious and cultural differences they had, and it was all about getting the Germans to leave.
There's one point where a character named Maria is describing to a British officer who has flown in exactly what these different groups are. And it sounds like the left in America in the
1960s. Yeah, right. The splitters, yeah. There's the gapistas and the sapistas and just that. Numbers. After a while, it just didn't matter anymore, and it was just, let's get these people out of here.
Mary Doria Russell, you set this in a very specific place in northern Italy,
mm-hmm.
and you made up towns because you didn't want to be limited by the historical
right.
story of those towns, if you'd use real ones. What towns are actually in the location?
Porto Sant'Andrea takes place fictionally a little west of Genoa, which is in the northwest coast. Cuneo is actually a wedge of land, just as I described, between two rivers, and I named that Rocca Barbina. There was another town a little further up into that valley called Borgo San Dalmazzo, which was, in fact, destroyed during the war for harboring Jews and harboring resistance, and that became Borgo San Mauro.
You were there, right?
Yes.
What's it like now? Are there any signs that the war actually happened 50 years ago?
Well, there are endless memorials to the young men who died. I had an opportunity to go back to this area with a man named Alfred Feldman. There are two storylines in A Thread of Grace. One of them is based on The Priest, the Rabbi, and the Aviator, which comes out of Alexander Stille's book, and that's sort of the city story. The other plotline has to do with a group of 1,200 Jews who walked over the Maritime Alps in the company of the Italian Fourth Army on September 8, 1943, which was when Italy surrendered and made a separate peace with the Allies. Everybody thought that if you could get behind the Italian borders, the war was over and you were safe. They already knew that if you were behind Italian lines, you were safe, because the Italian occupation forces never turned a single Jew over to the Nazis. It drove the Gestapo crazy. I've read memoranda about this. They were driven completely nuts by the Italians. So everybody knew that you were okay if you were in Italian-occupied territory, and everybody tried to get back to Italy with the retreating armies. The soldiers were fabulous. They were just magnificent about this. They dropped their knapsacks, and they picked up Jewish toddlers, and they carried them over the mountains. That story is also the story of Alfred Feldman. I met his daughter at a science fiction convention, and she asked me what I was working on, and I said, it's about the Jewish underground in Genoa during the Nazi occupation. And she said, oh, you must meet my father. He's one of 1,200 Jews who walked over the Maritime Alps with the Italian army. And I went, so, oh, yeah, you're right, I got to meet him.
Where is he originally from?
He was from Belgium.
So he follows the story of Claudia.
Yeah, Claudette and Albert Bloom.
Did they actually encounter the traffic jam at Dunkirk?
Yes, yes. All of that was absolutely real. When I wrote this book, I felt like I was building a fictional building, but every brick was real. Endless stories of real things that happened. Yeah, there was a huge traffic jam in Dunkirk, and their car was pushed off into the weeds by the British Army that was preparing to run. They ended up having to walk.
Did you ever feel constrained by history?
History was writing the plot. History was happening to my characters. It was necessary for me to know everything that they would know. I chiseled down the amount that I had to absorb about the war by realizing that my characters would not have known everything, but they would know the big stuff that had happened. And so I did a lot of work on the timelines and all of that. For my characters, though, I worked from memoirs of people who had lived through that time. I worked from histories of what was happening in those valleys. I did a lot of interviews. And so I didn't feel so much constrained as required to edit. The stories in A Thread of Grace, which are incredible in the old meaning of the word, not to be believed, are the ones that I took directly from the memories of people who had been through that. All the plausible stuff is what I made up to tie their stories together, but all of the incredible stuff is real.
Mary Doria Russell, did you encounter an actual British paratrooper like that too?
No, but there was a memoir by one. I added a romance for him, a small romance that doesn't last very long. I put him in the context of my characters. But what that radio man remembered, he was a signalman, and he was dropped in by the Secret Service for the British to make contact with a resistance group. The plane goes down, and he was adopted by another resistance group, and he decided he would stay with them. So, yes, Simon Henley is based on a real person.
You have a large cast of characters.
Yes.
Were there more characters that you kind of had to cut out?
Yes, absolutely. I pruned it down as much as I could. I felt when I was doing this that I was telling Italy's story, that Italy was the main character here. And Italy's response to the Holocaust and Italy's response to occupation were the story. That was the story I wanted to tell. And the characters were formed up around particular aspects of that story. And there was a great deal of rewriting and pruning and cutting and rethinking how I would tell the story through their eyes and through their experiences until it felt as though each one of them was essential to the story and each event takes place organically within that character. I didn't want to make up cardboard people and push them through the history. That was what I was trying to avoid. So it took a long time to do that. That's one of the reasons it took 7 years to finish this thing.
One of the major characters is a guy named Schramm, who is a German deserter doctor. He's the one who brings back the story of the extermination camps to
yes.
the town.
And he's the only one who knows about those.
Now, in real life, did these people know about that?
No. Schramm is a fictional character, but his history, his biography, is completely plausible and comes out of the biographies of a number of people who were in his position. I did not come across a German deserter, but there could have been someone like him quite easily. But at the time, people in Italy were not aware of the death camps. The rumors had begun, but they were so outlandish that what sane person would believe that there were factories for killing people? And when you hear those kinds of rumors, if you're a sane person yourself, you try very hard to imagine how such an exaggeration might have come. Well, maybe they kill people who break a piece of equipment or who make a big mistake or something like that. But people didn't know it. People were unaware. That's where the trains were going. They thought they were being resettled.
And nobody knew except for some Germans.
The Germans who were involved with the extermination policy had done their very efficient best to make sure that that information didn't get out. They put enormous effort into maintaining the fiction of resettlement camps and labor camps and stuff till you walked into the shower room and the doors were locked and the Cyclone B was dropped in. And it worked. People didn't know. And they were standing right there about to die.
So when you're creating this whole tapestry and you're bringing in pieces of information like mm-hmm. that, you have to do it at specific times. You mm-hmm. have to bring the people together and apart at the specific times.
Yes.
If you've got a 50-person or 75-person or whatever it is cast of characters, mm-hmm. how do you manage to keep it consistent?
A lot of rewriting, a lot of editing. All of the people became real to me so that I was able to keep them all separate in my head. I also give my manuscripts to friends to read. And if they found that they couldn't remember somebody, if the character wasn't popping out well enough, then I would find some way to immediately cue the reader. Okay, now we're talking about the one-armed postman, Pierino. Okay, well, he is based on a neighbor of mine, on a man named Carmelo Fornari, who actually did survive the Second Battle of the Don in Russia and who was wounded at that battle but did not lose his arm. In my book, Pierino lost the arm so that I would be able to cue you immediately that he was getting used to using his left hand, or there were ways for me to remind you who Pierino was.
So Santino is big and ugly.
Ugly, built like a dung cart.
Mary Doria Russell, the character of the rabbi, his synagogue is beautiful. Is that a real synagogue?
Yes, that's the synagogue in Genoa.
And you've seen it?
Yes, both parts of it. The new part, which was built in the 1930s with money raised in the 20s, was very beautiful but very modern. All of the beauty came from proportion and from materials. And then we were taken downstairs to the chapel that had been moved from the old synagogue and was completely rebuilt. And it was a beautiful little jewel box and absolutely the polar opposite in terms of decoration. All of that was real, and it's from Genoa.
And the rabbi himself?
The rabbi that is featured in Alexander Stiele's book, Rabbi Pacifici, he and his wife Wanda, they were both caught very early in the occupation, and they ended up going to Auschwitz on two different freight cars of the same train. However, their children were taken into a school run by the Ursuline nuns, and I interviewed Emanuele Pacifici, who was the son of the rabbi. He was a big source for the section of Stiele's book, The Priest, the Rabbi, and the Aviator, because he was the son of that rabbi. I also was able to interview a number of people who were major people in Italian history. The Ardentine Cave Massacre in Rome is something that I only glance at. It happened. It's something that the people in my part of Italy would have heard about and certainly would have been terrified by. There were 32 Germans who were killed in a resistance bomb incident, and 24 hours later the Germans had killed 335 Italians in groups of five or nine, and it took hours. It took like 11 hours to shoot all of those people, and then they dynamited the caves. Now, that was a moment of atrocity that then any lingering willingness to put up with the occupation was lost at that point, and all of Italy turned on them.
Toward the end of the occupation, when it became clear that things were getting worse, it seems that people tend to die at the beginning and at the end of mm-hmm. these wars.
Yeah.
You have I think it's a church being blown up with 300 people in it.
Yes.
Is that real?
Yeah. And in fact, Italy is now, it's going through a new willingness to talk about that era. In the last 12 to 18 months, there was a village very much like that. Now, it wasn't Borgo San Dalmazzo, but it was a village like that where some 300 people were rounded up and herded in, and it was set fire to. That is just now coming out. It was a civil war at the end of World War II in Italy. There were approximately 100,000 people who had collaborated with the Germans who were either hanged or shot at the end of the war. And in order to be able to go on as one country, you simply have to stop talking about it for a while. And so that has been the case. History starts up again around 1948, and we don't talk about it before that. Now, after 60 years, people are starting to talk about it.
At the end of the book, or through the book, various characters die. I understand that in knowing that this was haphazard, one second you're there, the next second you're not, you could protect yourself all you want. It won't make a difference.
That's right. And that's what everybody who has been through that sort of life, where the fighting goes on month after month after month, and eventually, you know, you think you're lucky or you thank God and all of this, and after a while, you're beginning to realize that the whole notion of luck will turn on you, and it becomes increasingly difficult to think about it. You just have to stop. You just can't deal with it. So my son and I were talking about this. When I was writing this, Roberto Benigni's movie Life is Beautiful came out, and I was appalled by that movie. I was absolutely horrified by that. Now, right up until they get on the train, that's good, all right? That's Italy. people were assimilated. They were part of everybody had friends. You lived in the same neighborhoods, and it was great. The moment he got on that train, that's when the story started being insulting, inaccurate, and awful. That child in Life is Beautiful would have been dead within 40 minutes. It implied that if you were clever enough and you loved your child enough, you could protect him. And that's just such an insult to the people who are dead. What does that make them? Chumps? They didn't love their kids? They didn't think of a clever way to keep their children alive? So I hated that movie. And I was talking to my son about that, and I said, all right, I'm writing about a place where 85 to 87% of the Jews survive. How can I keep this from becoming a feel-good Holocaust story? And my son said, well, you got to whack Claudette, who was one of the main characters. He says, you got to make people fall in love with her, and then you got to kill her. And I went, I don't know about that. We talked about this for a while. We went home, and I ended up making a list of my characters, and my son flipped a coin. Heads, they live. Tails, they die. What I was trying to get away from was the idea that you could relax into the book and decide, oh, he's a main character, so he's going to live through it, and I can identify with him. I wanted you to feel the immediacy of the decisions that had to be made. It's coming at you faster than you can think it out, and it doesn't matter if you think it out anyway. So you mentally sign on to somebody's decision, and then you have to live with the fictional consequences of those.
Was Claudette, was she in that list, or did you kind of leave her out?
No, she was in the list, and she was supposed to live through it. There was one character for whom I reversed the decision of the coin. There was just one, and I decided that if I went with the coin toss, it would end up being too sentimental.
Let us suppose that final sequence taking place in 2007, that it had come up tails for Claudette. Who would have been that character?
I don't know, because when I write the books, I often know that I'm aiming at a particular event or a piece of dialogue that I know I want to be there. But the coda is not something that happened ahead of time. And so I may have gone in an entirely different way. And it wasn't until I was on the final revision. Once you have the whole book is there and you know where everybody ends up and you know how the story ends for them or doesn't end, then it gives you more room to begin to think about what would be the response of this character to life after the war.
If the coin had come up heads for Renzo, his death seemed inevitable.
I might have left him, you know, a drunken derelict. He might have been the one that I pick up at the end in 2007, you know. Yeah. Well, he wouldn't have lived that long, but, you know, he might have been the coda.
Mary Doria Russell, there, in a sense, are three endings. There's the ending of the war. There's the rabbi 2 years later where we learn about some other things. Mm-hmm. And then there's this other little coda. I walked away from the whole book very, very sad because everyone is damaged.
One of the things that you find out when you read memoirs of people who lived through those times, these people who were not in the camps, because I wasn't reading about people who were in the camps. I was reading about the people who were staying one step ahead of the Nazis, like Alfred Feldman and like his father. One of the things I recognized when I read those was that they were curiously flat emotionally. Alfred had written a book-length memoir called One Step Ahead. And I got him an agent, and they found out that it was not commercial. I did eventually say, look, what you want to do is maybe take this to Southern Illinois University. They have a wonderful press there that has done a lot of memoirs like this. That's where you belong. And, in fact, he was published by them. But the commercial editors said, it's flat emotionally. It's such an exciting story, but I'm not getting any emotional buzz off that. And he got in touch with me. He said, do you think I should rewrite it? Because I think I've said everything that I could bring to it. And I said, Alfred, I think that in order to bring the emotion into this, it would take years of therapy. And I don't know if you want to go there. You might want to talk this over with your family, because it's going to change everything. Everybody in his family wanted him to go through therapy. And when he told me that, he said, as for me, I thought of ice, which is a line that I give to Claudette at the end of this book. He understood that in order to survive what he had survived, he had to repress every emotion he had. He had to become completely rational. He had to be able to react minute by minute to what was happening around him. And that seems to be the case for people who lived through this war.
Can we learn anything about what our government is doing today by reading a book like this?
Oh, I think so. I think so. When I began this, I thought I was writing about history. And very quickly, I was immersed in a time of history in my own country where I was able to take lines being said by people in charge of my government, and I slotted them directly into dialogue in my book without changing a word. The emotions of occupation and the emotions of resistance to occupation are the same. It doesn't matter why the occupiers are there. It doesn't matter if you're there because you want to bestow the blessings of democracy on someone, or if you're there to take their oil, or if you're there to get slave labor for your factories. It doesn't matter. The resistance will be there nevertheless. I began to realize that the tactics that I was seeing in Fallujah on both sides were the same dynamic. When writing this book, it was very clear to me that the resistance were the heroes and the occupiers were the bad guys. And very quickly in Iraq, it was clear that you have to scramble the labels. It's not so clear cut. So yes, I think that people reading The Thread of Grace are going to get much more insight into clergymen who are part of the resistance, the various political reasons for resistance, and the outcome of resistance.
Whatever the motives of the invading army might be, and however nice the soldiers might attempt to be,
it just doesn't matter. Renzo Leone, one of my characters, is present at a time when a German general is shot. And just before he dies, the German general says, "You ate at my table. You danced with my wife." And Renzo can only reply, "You occupied my country." And ultimately, it comes down to that.
There's another ethical element here, which, of course, is the following orders element, which comes in with Schramm.
Yes.
And it even comes in with the partisans a couple of times when it's obvious they're going to have to do things. At what point does individual responsibility end? And I see a link between that and your earlier books, too.
Yes, exactly. Renzo believes that if what he did in the Abyssinian War can be brushed off, civilization is over. I think Renzo's right. Schramm has a genuine moment of conversion. He is born again, not in those terms particularly, but Schramm genuinely regrets what he did.
He killed 90,000
people. He killed 91,867 people, but now he's sorry. Now,
but it's a real problem because
the other
people
priest,
say, we can't let that go. We
right,
can't forgive
right.
you. We can't
there is
let that
a, there
go.
Is a priest to whom Schramm confesses this.
Have you run across any Germans with Schramm's attitude who survived the war?
There is one doctor who is featured in a lot of documentary films. I forget his name. I would have it in my notes. But he was in charge of the doctors at Auschwitz. So he was a colleague of Mengele's. He lives with himself by believing that there was nothing he could have done. And so he tried to mitigate things somewhat. Well, Schramm tried to get out of it. Schramm left. Schramm volunteered to work on the Russian front.
Yeah.
He left. He got out of it, and then he deserted when he had the opportunity. And I wanted to make crystal clear the issue of, are there unforgivable sins, which is the backbone, in my mind, to this book. Renzo is a Jew. Murder and slander are unforgivable sins because they can't be reversed. He never lets himself off that hook, but he can't live with it. Like Primo Levi, he ends up hanging himself at the end. Primo Levi, what did he do? He failed to share a piece of bread with a third person. There were three guys who shared everything. Two of them found a piece of bread and they divided it in half. Ultimately, he could not live with this. Now, I can think of a lot of ways that I would find that okay, but he didn't. And yet, Mengele died in the fullness of his years surrounded by his grandchildren. They found ways to decide that what they did was okay or what they did was... Usually people, when they've done something bad, they distance themselves by saying, I'm not the person who did that. I'm not the same man.
What are you working on now?
I just signed the contract for a fourth novel. It's about the 1921 Cairo Peace Conference, which gave us the modern Middle East. My main characters are Lawrence of Arabia, Winston Churchill, and Lady Gertrude Bell, who drew the map of Iraq.
You know, of course, that one of the difficulties there is just by naming a character, the character isn't that person. It's up to you to make it that person.
Oh, yes, I will have to work
with
it.
And that's a tough one.
Yeah. It's going to be different technical puzzles to solve. And I'm having a grand time with it. I'm really enjoying this one.
Do you think the puzzle solving is more fun than the actual writing or the research?
No, that's actually the part that I really enjoy. I like all that part. And I like having my fingers on the keyboard and making the prose happen. The hard part is where I will know where I want to get, and I don't have the right character to see it, or I haven't worked out. I haven't solved the puzzle.
That's right, yeah.
And to me, those are always the best chapters later on. I rewrote chapter 3 in this book 16 times. I knew that Renzo was out drinking with Schramm the night before, and I knew somebody comes through the door and lays waste to him for the bad judgment that that represented. I couldn't find the right person to come through the door. I wrote and wrote and wrote. I tried to write around it, through it, over it. It wasn't until I realized that I really had 3 points of view and I only had 2 characters. That third person was Renzo's mother, Lydia. She becomes the 70-year-old action hero of the novel, and until I found her, it would not get written.
Mary Doria Russell, were there any characters who suddenly came to life and you had to go back and add them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Lydia was one. She was amazing to me. Because I was having so much trouble figuring out who walked through the door when Renzo was hungover, I finally fell back onto the idea of, well, write a biography for Renzo. And that's where I came up with this idea of Renzo flew before he could walk. He is the 7th child. He is the first son. All of a sudden, I got, wait a minute, this is an Italian Jewish mother who didn't have a son until she was 40. Oh, my God, the little prince. And so the relationship between Renzo and his mom started out very much like the relationship between my son and I. It was very close, very on the same wavelength. And in order to make it less easy, I had to give Lydia a lot more edge, and I had to put a lot more conflict in their relationship than there was between me and my son. And she becomes the action hero. Renzo wants no part of war. He's tried having enemies. It was a mistake. Lydia wants to fight.
Mary Doria Russell, Hollywood usually comes a calling at some point. Has there been any interest in either The Sparrow or this book?
The Sparrow we are actively developing. We went through the mill once at Universal Studios. Did not work out. Now we're at Warner Brothers. This time, all the principals, everybody has read the book rather than a 30-page synopsis of The Sparrow, and they want to do the story that I wrote. I have great hopes for it this time. As for A Thread of Grace, we've got one nibble from an Italian film company, but I haven't heard anything more about that.
You've been listening to an interview with Mary Doria Russell, whose latest novel is A Thread of Grace. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.